Hi, everybody. Happy New Year's Eve. I'm Allison Stewart, and you are listening to All of It on WNYC. Earlier this year, we launched a series called Flashback Friday, Party Like It's 1999.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Mumbo number 5.
Gentlemen, welcome to Fight Club.
That is not my recollection. My recollection is that I did not have sexual relations.
Oh, for you!
If you ask the question, where will the Y2K computer bug do serious damage? The answer is, no one really knows.
Goodbye.
Throughout the year, we featured cultural moments, shows, movies, and events that turned 20 in 2019. Since it's the last day of the year, it's our last opportunity to salute some of those moments. First up, a conversation with journalist and author John Peet about the 20th anniversary of the founding of the euro. On January 1st, 1999, the euro was adopted by 11 nations. The day before, one commentator at The Economist called it, quote, the biggest risk the EU has ever taken, and arguably the most momentous currency innovation since the establishment of the United States dollar in 1792. Since then, the eurozone has expanded to include 19 of the EU's 28 member states. It's also survived a couple of financial crises over the 20-year history. So now we take a look back at the euro, where it came from, what it's been through, and what to make of it now. John Peet is The Economist's political and Brexit editor and author of Unhappy Union, How the Euro Crisis and Europe Can Be Fixed. Take a listen to our conversation. Looking back, what has been the euro's biggest strength and what has been its most obvious shortcoming?
Well, I think its biggest strength is that it survived. I mean, there were plenty of people who worried when it started that it wasn't going to work, that putting different countries together and sharing a currency like this without political union wouldn't work. And it has been tested several times now through various euro crises. So I think its biggest strength is it's still there. Its biggest sort of weakness, I think, is that it remains incomplete. There isn't a fully functioning banking union to underpin it, and it isn't quite clear what would happen if there was another euro crisis, particularly on the question of whether there is any sort of fiscal firepower that governments need when you head into financial crises. So if we have another financial crisis, the euro could be vulnerable once again.
So let's roll back. European citizenship was officially established just 6 years before the euro. At the time, what was the idea for the euro? Why was it introduced? What was it supposed to solve?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I mean, one answer to it is that the idea of a common money and a common currency has actually been knocking around since the 1950s, since the European project began. There were a lot of people who thought that the only way to bring this project together successfully would be to have a shared currency. So it has actually a much longer history than people think. Mm. The reason it came back again in the 1980s and early 1990s was primarily because the European Union, as it then became, had formed this complete single market, no barriers, no trade barriers, no customs checks or anything. And that made having different currencies inside Europe very complicated, difficult, and it worried people. Germans were worried that if the Italians devalued, that would give the Italians a competitive advantage over German industry and they wouldn't be able to fight back. So there was a sort of logic that once you've eliminated all barriers internally, you also need a single currency. And many people looked at the United States and said that's how it works in the United States. The dollar is a single currency. Most barriers to internal trade have gone, and they kind of go together. So that thought was there, and it became a sort of driver during the 1990s. We need to have a single currency to build Europe, to make it a stronger union.
At the time, who were the critics of the euro, and what was their position?
Well, interestingly, the critics, there were some critics in Germany. The German Central Bank was very worried that particularly if countries like Italy or later Greece were to join, the German taxpayers would have to bail them out. And indeed, to some extent, that their criticisms proved true, although actually Germany has benefited a lot from the euro. But the much bigger band of critics, curiously, were people not in the euro, particularly the United States and the United Kingdom, where people just said, look, we think that the politics doesn't work. You can't have a single currency without a closer political union. You're going to have to take this project forward and have sort of, you know, common tax powers and so on, and build something that looks a bit like the United States of America. And in both America and Britain, there was a great deal of skepticism about whether Europe would be able to do that. And indeed, it hasn't done that, but it has taken steps in that direction. And I think the sort of question about the future of the euro continues to be, how much more political union does it need in order to work better and survive?
John, who named the euro?
Sorry, who?
Who named the euro? How did it become the euro?
It was in 1996, actually. I was there when they unveiled this at the time that they also unveiled the notes. It was a choice. It was born in the 1992 Maastricht Treaty, and they said we'll have a single currency in 7 years. They didn't name it at that time, and then they talked about it and said we'll have the euro mark or something like that. And eventually, I think it was particularly Helmut Kohl, the German Chancellor, who said, "Look, a simple word. Let's just call it the euro."
So as the euro developed, this first wave of 11 countries, how were these 11 countries identified that would be part of it?
And that was also part of the criticism in Germany. Because the Germans were worried that they might be asked to subsidize what they saw as profligate Mediterranean countries, they wrote into the treaty setting up the single currency criteria which included you must have a low budget deficit, you must have a low public debt, you must have low inflation, and you must have a stable exchange rate, and you must have done that for a period. The idea of that was to make sure that countries that didn't fulfill those criteria, one of which was Italy, wouldn't be able to join the euro at the beginning. But the politics became very difficult. You know, Italy was a founder member of the club. I mean, it was making huge efforts to reduce its deficit and its debt. And in the end, it was decided that actually all countries that wanted to join should be allowed to join, with the exception of Greece. And then Greece was quietly let in a couple of years later, and then gradually the club has evolved. But one of the problems for the euro was indeed that this attempt to keep out countries with very high public debt just didn't work. And the result is there are countries in the euro which have very high public debt, Italy being the most notable example, but Greece being another.
My guest is John Peet, the Economist, political and Brexit editor. We're talking about the history of the euro. The euro is has turned 20 years old this year in 2019. Let's talk about some major milestones. When was the durability of the euro first really tested?
It was particularly in the financial crisis. I mean, there had been some problems. You know, when it first started, its value sank against the dollar. Then later on, it became too strong against the dollar. So there were some problems, and people were worried, particularly about Greece and Italy. But the really decisive thing was what happened in 2008, 2009, when the financial crisis, the biggest financial crisis in sort of 80 years, hit. At first, Europeans were saying, well, that's a problem for America. It started in America. It's caused by American subprime mortgages. It's not going to affect us. We're going to be fine. But it rapidly became clear that European banks were very heavily involved in subprime mortgages and were actually troubled. And then it became clear that Greece had lied about its own deficit and public debt. And that evolved into what was called a sovereign debt crisis, worries particularly about Greece, but then later about Portugal, Spain, and Ireland. And that sorting that out took the Europeans much longer than it took the United States to sort out its reaction to the financial crisis. And I think that's been troubling the European Union ever since.
Has any good come out of these critical moments in the euro history?
Well, some people would say, look, Germany has certainly done quite well. It's had a very successful 20 years in the euro. Some of the northern countries like the Netherlands that have been in have done quite well. You can't really quite answer the question of what would have happened if there hadn't been a euro, because without the euro, the financial crisis could have had terrible consequences in Europe. You know, there would have been huge currency movements that could have pulled the whole European Union apart. But I think it would be fair to say that the southern countries of Europe, Italy, Greece, Spain, Portugal, have not done as well as they hope to do as members of the euro, and they continue to be the vulnerable sort of side of the European Union.
So, what does the European Central Bank need to do to keep the euro viable for the next 20 years? Let's say.
Well, I think it's done enough. You know, I mean, one of the most famous moments in the euro crisis came in 2012, when the president of the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, announced that he, as head of central bank, would do whatever it took to save the euro. And at that moment, you know, the euro crisis sort of started to mend itself. So I think the European Central Bank is in reasonably good shape. The problems that it can't solve, the first is low growth, particularly in southern Europe, which is a whole variety of reasons. Productivity is not going up, the demographics aren't good, competitiveness is suffering. And the other thing that needs to be solved is the governments of the Eurozone countries need to work out together what kind of union they need to form to make sure that their banks are secure if there's another financial crisis, and to make sure that they have enough firepower in either spending or tax to sort of step in if there's a financial crisis. I mean, it was notable that America was able to step in with a much larger bailout for its banks in 2008-09 than the Europeans could do, because the Europeans couldn't agree on who should foot the bill. There is not a European Treasury equivalent to the United States Treasury.
My guest has been John Peet, the Economist political and Brexit editor. John, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC.